Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the perils of anti-woke comedy, the joys of Wetherspoons, and the bizarre row over an ultra-processed yogurt shot. Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every single episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Happy New Year, listeners.
Happy New Year to you. We're delighted to be joined in this episode, first time on the show, by Lou Perez. Lou is a comedian and is the author of the book That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore. Lou, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lou, the reason we wanted to get you on was to talk about comedy, offence, anti-woke comedy, which has sort of come back in the news because of the fact that Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais have had new Netflix specials out in the space of a couple of days of each other. And there has been this incredibly predictable backlash. There was actually a campaign over in the UK by various disabled charities for them to remove the word retard from Ricky Gervais's special because supposedly it was ableist and hate speech. Dave Chappelle prompts the same response every time he puts out a special now, which is that he's a transphobe. And generally, there's just been a lot of discussion about how these comedians are being both lazy and prejudicial in what they do, that this anti-woke comedy shtick that they're supposedly engaging in is just, you know, bigotry for cheap laughs. What have you made of this latest round of what feels like a kind of never-ending discussion?
Yeah, I think it says something about the culture where, you know, nowadays it seems like the only time that I end up watching a special is if I need to like analyze it to discuss it on a podcast. You know, it's sort of that's become in a way like, is that the point of comedy where I need to, you know, where I would much prefer to approach comedy specials as a fan of comedy and wanting to go in because I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to laugh. I'm going to have a good time. So I have to admit, the only reason why I watched the Ricky Gervais special and the Dave Chappelle special was because of the alleged controversies. And, you know, something that I think with both specials that I noticed is it seems like a lot of the subject matter and even some of the jokes were rather dated. Like, I feel like anybody who's been, you know, living a good part of their life online and on Twitter in particular, it's sort of like a lot of these jokes felt like they were a couple years old. And for me, that's unfortunate because when you're going to watch a special by Ricky Gervais or Dave Chappelle, I really want to see masters at work, you know, masters at their in their art form. And I thought it was kind of like lacking that this time around. And with the Ricky Gervais one, I don't know if you guys noticed it, but there seemed to be a lot of fake laughter. I don't know who recorded the audience, but it seemed like a lot of stuff was put in post. The pacing was weird. So when I approached it, I wasn't offended by, you know, any of the jokes. You know, to be fair, it does take a lot for me to be offended, but it didn't feel like a very good special. One that I think most people would enjoy outside of whatever supposed offense that it was causing, retards, or I don't know.
The retard community.
Yeah.
We should give some props to that. No, I think it's a fair point because one of the, I mean, Ricky Gervais has always been one in terms of his stand-up, could never quite get into myself. It's not really where he began life in comedy. Obviously he was writing sitcoms. He came to it quite late, which people who are involved in stand-up tend to say is not always the best start when you're already famous because you can usually bank on a laugh quite quickly. Chappelle's a funny one as far as I love Dave Chappelle. He's like my favorite comedian, grew up with him. But the ones that the specials that people have recently really got upset about tended not to be the best ones. Do you think there's a bit of a problem with people are just obsessing over the subject of the material rather than just working out, is this funny or not?
Yeah, I think so. His previous special, so I guess the latest one is Dreamer. And then the previous one was The Closer. And in The Closer, that one was very controversial because he went through a personal story about a trans friend of his who committed suicide. And I hold up that bit in particular as a masterpiece of comedy in that it was able to go to very dark place, suicide, take on a controversial subject of the trans stuff, and then also make it very funny and also very heartwarming. And I think that's an example of Dave Chappelle at his best. And then I think like this time around, I believe he had like maybe one or two jokes about trans, you know, people. And he attempted, I think, to do sort of a similar thing towards the end of the latest special, sort of bring it everything together in kind of a deep way. And I just don't think it really worked, you know, this time. But of course, critics are going to glom onto, I think, the trans stuff. And he also, had some jokes about, you don't call them cripples. Handicapped, disabled people as well. You know, so it's one of those things. I feel like there's subject matter words that, you know, trigger people that will get their attention and that will sort of shut them down from experiencing anything beyond that, which I think is unfortunate. But I think overall, I think we're getting away from that, and I think more and more people are just able to see, you know, what's being made and say like, okay, was this actually, you know, good? Was this actually funny?
Chris, I'm not sure if you've seen either of these specials, but what have you made of the discussion swirling around all of it, if nothing else?
Yeah, I've seen them. I've seen all of Chappelle's specials and Gervais's specials on Netflix, I think. I paid for it, so I might as well sit down and watch it for an hour. So I watched them more or less when they came out, and I didn't think they were as good as some of the previous ones. I think they've both been phoning it in for a while, in my opinion. I mean, I don't think they're anywhere near the best stand-up comedians in the world, which, you know, based on how much they get paid by Netflix, you would think they were. Gervais is, like you say, he's never really been a stand-up in my eyes, although he's been doing it for quite a long time. He's pretty good at it. I like them both, don't get me wrong. I think they're both funny guys. But there was, I don't know, I only laughed two or three times, I think, in each one of those. There's a big kind of gap between jokes and the Chappelle stuff in particular. And some of Gervais's jokes are a bit forced. I don't mind them. I don't even think they're that controversial. It doesn't seem to me that controversial, especially compared to some other comedians. You know, Netflix should give like Jerry Sadowitz a special or Doug Stanhope a special. And then we test the limits of free speech a bit. And I'm not even sure people who believe in the kind of transubstantiation theory agenda are that offended by it. I mean, probably most of them don't watch it. And those who do probably just touch and go, well, that's more or less what I expected these bigots to say. You know, who cares? I feel we've almost like gone past the peak of the whole trans thing now. Most people have made up their mind about it, and most people are not really on board. So kind of good on them for taking this on when it was a bit more of a sensitive issue. I just don't feel like, maybe partly thanks to what they've done, maybe, I don't think people are that sensitive about it anymore. I'll give them both, you know, 7 stars, but I didn't think they were that amazing. And I certainly didn't think they were particularly controversial until I started reading about it, of course. Probably a funnier thing than either of the specials was the Guardian review of both of them. That was great. Because Chappelle...
Was this the one that accused them of sinking to nude?
Yeah, which is what you want. I mean, that's exactly what anyone who follows these guys wants to hear. They should put that on the advert, you know. But this guy was, because Chappelle kind of closes by saying, you know, trans women are the ultimate dreamers, because, you know, any man who wants to become a woman is dreaming, you know, in the best possible way or whatever. And the Guardian review was like, well, no, trans woman is not pretending, you know, not dreaming of being a woman. She is a woman and all this. So that was quite funny. But I think time to move on to some new material, probably for the next specials for both of them.
it's worth remembering how, I think, important was it the closer, that Dave Chappelle special, when there was all of that outrage over it because some of the gender material, and that really became a real flashpoint. That felt like that was a point in which Netflix had to kind of make a choice. Was it going to listen to its junior employees who were in open revolt, and even some of their kind of showrunners in open revolt about this particular special? It has to be ripped down. There were protests outside. If you remember, there was a counter protest. It was a very bizarre moment in the sort of culture war. But they did, in a slightly half-hearted way, in some respects. Nevertheless, Netflix did stand by him and free expression.
I don't know. It wasn't even half-hearted. They were great. They said, look, if you don't like this, get another job. I thought that what they said was fantastic.
There was definitely like a series of statements, some more firm than the other. But yeah, it was like free speech won the day in that respect. So it was quite important. But going back to that question of is it a bit tired, I suppose, Lou, you yourself, you do some fantastic sort of anti-woke material. Both of these comedians we're talking about have, in other specials, I think it's fair to say, really nailed some of these phenomenons, or at least just turned it into great comic material, regardless of what point they're trying to make. But is there a bit of a danger with anti-woke comedy having some of the same problems as woke comedy, insofar as it's geared towards agreement rather than laughter, or it just becomes a similar kind of paint by numbers, if I talk about pronouns or if I talk about heterosexual queers, in the case of Ricky Gervais or whatever it might be, there's a certain section of the audience who will get it and laugh. Do you reckon we're kind of stumbling into that kind of problem with anti-woke comedy, so-called?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, that's the challenge where you hear a lot of people often say like, oh man, things are so ridiculous. The jokes write themselves. And it's like, well, if you're a comedian, you really don't want the jokes to write themselves. You want to be the writer of the jokes because, you know, your aim is for not only to entertain, but also to be original and to, you know, demonstrate a new point of view on what you're doing. So I think that's, you know, something someone could easily fall into. In this last special, I mean, Ricky Gervais kind of falls into it himself. I mean, he brings up Clapter without mentioning Clapter, the idea of, you know, people just laughing or applauding along with you because they agree with you. And it's like, well, dude, you just did a whole hour of that. You know, I mean, you just did exactly what you were accusing others of doing. And I think, you know, when you talk about the flashpoint with Netflix, I think that's totally true. And also there were, you know, two other phenomena that happened around that same time. There was Chris Rock being slapped by Will Smith, which Dave Chappelle discusses in his new special, and also Dave Chappelle being attacked on stage, I believe at the Hollywood Bowl, when he was performing shortly after that. Somebody. I think all of that together, you know, having a large corporation like Netflix saying, no, we're going to stand behind our comedians, and then having a public at large say like, oh, no, hold on. You're not going to be attacking comedians. You're not going to physically, you know, go after comedians. We're not going to accept that. I think those were big moves for sure, and for you know, for free speech and comedy.
And of course, your book is all about this, Lou. But are you sort of optimistic about where things are going? Are we kind of out of that slightly stultifying sort of culture? It felt like we were more in a few years ago where comedy is concerned.
Yeah, I think so for sure. My book is definitely one of hope, and I think there's really good reason to believe that. And I, you know, one of the biggest, it, you know, being, you know, the technology that we have to be able to put stuff out, and as comedians reach huge audiences. Last week I did a short parody video. It was about 45 seconds long about Harvard's Claudine Gay, that controversy. You know, it took me, you know, 10 minutes to shoot, 20 minutes to edit, and then I uploaded it to Twitter, and it, you know, has over 150,000 views. And it's sort of like, you know, what an incredible reach that I have. And the responses to it have been, you know, very favorable. And I think having Twitter X being a platform that I think a lot more people feel freer now to post stuff without fear of being taken down. I think that's really important. And also the monetization side too. I mean, I forget how many months now, but I've been making money on Twitter. I never thought that would be possible. I've been, you know, pouring out so much of my unpaid labor into Twitter. It's finally coming back, baby. So I'm very, very hopeful for where things are going.
And on that, everyone should go and follow Lou on Twitter. His stuff, very, very funny. I particularly like that video from a while back of you have this kind of recurring character, which is a sort of wokester of some description. Almost looks exactly like you do now, but with a hat and glasses, not dissimilar to this one, where you talk about why you're going to, what was it, a children's playground to talk to have conversations about gender, which is, I will leave it at that because I don't want to butcher it, but it's definitely worth checking his stuff out. Chris, should we talk about some of the, I was going to say nanny state, but just booze and food related stories really this week that we're going to discuss. First off, should we talk about Tim Martin and Weatherspoons? because I feel like he's kind of the patron saint of this podcast in many respects. He's obviously the founder of the pub chain, beloved by Brits, who has finally been given a knighthood in the New Year's honours. And given the fact that Wetherspoons is seen as a quite low status, shall we say, place, particularly by very snobby kind of Remainers on Twitter who were apoplectic about this particular appointment. This, it's kind of brought that whole issue back. I know you wrote a piece for The Spectator asking why it had taken Tim Martin so long to be given a knighthood. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what you wrote in that piece?
Yeah, well, I should probably explain for Lou's benefit exactly who this guy is and what Wetherspoons is. It's kind of hard to describe what Wetherspoons is. It's a chain of pubs, but it's not. They're not all exactly the same, right? It's not like McDonald's or something like that. So they're fairly similar. But what he mainly does is he takes over old buildings, some of them really very nice listed buildings, and turns them into usually fairly big pubs. And he's got about 900 of these, and he sells beer at an incredibly cheap price. Like even in London, it would be sort of £2.70 for a pint. In some places, it's at the moment he's selling it for £1.99 a pint, which is like, you know, ridiculously cheap. No one quite knows how he does it, including me, but God bless him for doing it. And he's the victim of a certain group of people in society for two reasons. One is some people just don't like his pubs because they're they cater too much to normal people and people who like drinking rather than people who just like to have, you know, one pint of craft beer and 20 pound fish and chips. And the other, he was quite vocally in favour of Brexit. So some of the Remainers attempted a boycott of his pubs, which didn't really work because they never went there in the first place. But yeah, he's been a bit of a villain figure, I guess, amongst some of the people who can't get over the result of the 2016 referendum. And he got a knighthood, and these people are all moaning about it and saying that he only got this because of Brexit, which is in itself a perfectly reasonable thing to get a knighthood for, I think, really, you know. But he didn't. The official reason was services to hospitality and business. Absolutely right. I think it should have been services to charity with the prices he's charging for his drinks. I think no one has done more to get Britain through the cost of living crisis than Tim Martin. And he continues to do so. So, yeah, I wrote a piece. In fact, quite a few people wrote pieces of a similar nature. I think Fraser wrote one for Spike, didn't he?
Saying, he did, yes.
Arise, Sir Tim, an absolute legend. But, yeah, they are genuinely great, great pubs to go to. But mainly because of the price. But they keep winning Loo of the Year awards. The toilets are notoriously clean. There's no music playing. They're just like old, you know, normal locals, really. And the idea of a local has kind of died out for a lot of people, particularly under the age of 40, simply because you can't afford to go to the pub on a regular basis. And Wetherspoons are virtually the only pubs in the country where you can afford to go quite often and drink a reasonable amount, by which I mean a lot. And, we should be celebrating people like that.
We definitely should. I mean, I think you're so right about people who've just never set foot in them. Because what is it that they're possibly taking offence to other than who they imagine to be the clientele? Like, they're even like people who work in them. Like, they're very polite. You know, the places are looked after. It's not like a kind of crack den, as some of them are trying to make out.
No, I mean, you do get a few, let's call them what they are, alcoholics in there. But why shouldn't alcoholics have a nice place to go as well, rather than just sit at home drinking? And it can get a bit messy late at night, I guess. But, you know, that's just the British pub trade for you, isn't it? They're remarkably clean and safe and nice places to be in my opinion.
It did make me laugh because when we put out our piece from Fraser on Wetherspoons, celebrating it, rightly so, Otto English, who's this, as many people will know, this sort of diehard Remona sort of character, you know, he kind of quote tweeted it and he was saying, why are they so obsessed with me? And he was like, unlike them, I was actually in a Wetherspoons the other night. And then I responded to him, really? And he was like, I was going to get my teenagers.
Oh, really?
So even in that moment of trying to pretend.
He tweeted that to me, actually. He said something along the line, these people seem to think that there's some, you get some sort of working class cred for saying you've been in Wetherspoons, which is something that nearly everybody, I would have thought, has done at some point in their lives. And a lot of people obviously go quite a bit. It's a thriving pub chain. Yeah, and he said something along the lines of, well, what you say? I mean, I was in one the other day. I bet Mr. Snowden's never stepped foot in one. A few people said that on Twitter. Like, why the hell would I have just written an article about Wetherspoons, saying how good they are, specifically mentioning some Wetherspoons I've just been to in the last few weeks? What, if I've never been in one, why would I do that? You know, it's very peculiar people. Because they're just such ordinary, you know, a lot of people go to Wetherspoons not even notice it's a Wetherspoons. It's not, because they're not called Wetherspoons. They all have a different name, you know. And they're just, you know, they're just pubs. It's a weird thing to make such a, such a song and dance about.
Well, during COVID, you know, in particular, you have that, you know, what an incredible impact COVID had just on bars and pub culture and all that. And when you think of, like, you know, older guys who that's where they spend their day, no longer having a place to go. And I think it's really easy for people just to, you know, forget that those men even exist. But the way that you guys are describing it, I mean, it sounds like heaven, because one of the things that I hate is when you go to a place and the music is just blaring.
Yeah.
You can't speak to, you can't hear anybody. It's like, I'm definitely aged beyond my years and what I'm looking for of, like, I'm more of a, what's it, Hemingway's, a clean, well-lighted place. You know, it's what I'm looking for.
Well, next time you come to London, we'll take you to a few Wetherspoons.
He was also quite anti-lockdown, wasn't he? Of course, I'd forgotten that. That was another reason they don't like him. Because he was, you know, just from a business point of view, obviously the lockdowns were really damaging the pub trade, plus all the other stuff most people have probably forgotten now, all the ludicrous rules that you had. Even when we weren't in lockdown, we could only have six people go into pub. You had to order a Scotch egg and you had to sit down, tables, all this kind of stuff. So he was pretty skeptical about lockdown. And he also has his magazine, Lou, which I'm told is either the first or second biggest, has the first or second biggest readership in the country. It claims to have 2 million readers. It's on the tables for 3 months, so I can well believe it would have about that many readers. And he uses that to hold forth on various issues that are dear to his heart, and particularly the you know, various claims around COVID and lockdowns. I should say, by the way, because Simon Clark pointed this out, Simon Clark, friend of the show, from Forest, the freedom organization to enjoy smoking tobacco, he pointed out that Tim Martin actually was an early cheerleader for the smoking ban and has since banned vaping in all his pubs, which is true. And that probably should be taken down on the other side of the ledger. I should remember that because I actually wrote about it in a book once. But he decided to make some of his Wetherspoon pubs smoke-free in about 2004, 2005, and they all lost money really, really quickly. So he put a halt to that and then instead lobbied the government for the old level playing field and said we should have a smoking ban everywhere. And yes, you can't vape in Wetherspoons, but I think that's true in most pub chains. I just assume you can't vape in most pub chains, but if you do it discreetly, it's no problem.
You just smell candy. Smoke candy.
I'm on the unflavored, you see, so I get away with it more easily than some.
So unless there's any more on Wetherspoons, Chris, do you want to give us a quick update on what Tim Spector's been getting up to? So for the sake of our audience, as well as Lou here, who has been suffering through some very heavily conversations about the past 10 minutes. Tim Spector, he is a sort of professor / diet guru. He was the guy behind the Zoe COVID symptom tracker app. And since then, this kind of Zoe diet cult, I think is the only really way to describe it. You see people out there engaged in this. He's also brought out a probiotic yogurt drink, which has been accused of being ultra processed. Chris, do you want to explain what's happened here and what's the significance of it to our listeners?
Yeah, so he's written numerous books, all of which are along the lines of everything you've been told about food is wrong kind of stuff, you know, and I'll tell you the truth if you pay £15 for this book. And as you say, he was behind the Zoe COVID app, which a lot of people who were very hysterical about COVID preferred to the official COVID data, because it always made it look like there was a much bigger wave of COVID than there actually was. And then on at least one occasion, he would then quietly retrospectively change all the graphs so it actually looked like the real data. So his latest thing, he's jumped on the ultra-processed food bandwagon, of course, all of a sudden. And now he's put out this food supplement called Gutshot, which doesn't even sound that nice, does it? Gutshot, a shot to the gut.
Sounds like being punched.
Yeah, stuff, right.
Like rather.
And it's been launched in Marks and Spencer's, of course, and it contains something like, I think they're claiming it's like 14 million bacteria in one serving, which again sounds delicious, doesn't it? But it also includes various exotic ingredients that I can't remember the name of, but I don't have in my kitchen. And this is a point, right? So, Lou, the standard layman's definition of ultra-processed food is anything in plastic that contains at least one ingredient you don't have in your kitchen. I don't have much more than, you know, some jam and ham in my kitchen, but I certainly don't have the stuff these could put in this. I've probably got some bacteria, to be fair. I've probably got at least 14 million bacteria in my kitchen, but I haven't got the other stuff to it. So he has quite rightly, I think, been accused of flogging ultra-processed food. Now, he might say in his defense that it's not really food. It is a supplement, which I could go along with, except for the fact that he's also quite recently described people who buy food supplement as, quote, mugs. And so the whole thing's a ripoff. So he's found yet another way to make some money here, Tim. You know, and God love him for it, I guess. It's a free market. I haven't worked out what other ingredients are in this thing because I haven't actually seen it anywhere. But it just shows, doesn't it, again, how hard it is to be one of these people pontificating about diet while at the same time making money out of food. It's like Jamie Oliver complaining about sugar, and then you just look in his cookbooks and, oh, there's masses of sugar in everything, and you're roasting pork in Coca-Cola. It's very difficult not to be a hypocrite, I guess. But he could try a little bit harder, perhaps.
And Lou, has this sort of panic about what over here is often gets called ultra-processed food made it over to the US? Is it something that you've noticed? Because this keys into this particular story, which is for months now, there's been this obsession with any form of food which isn't kind of artisan made is not only bad for you, but is almost like crack cocaine addictive, is this sort of discussion we've been having over here. Has there been anything similar in the US?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's made its way all the way over to the United States, and it's made its way all the way into my body, too. I am one of these people. I have fallen down that rabbit hole and followed it as far as I can. I'm actually waiting when I open up Instagram, I'm sure they're going to try to be selling me that gut punch crap that I just brought up. I'm not familiar with this guy in particular, but in the States, some of the big things, I don't know if they're necessarily fads or just, you know, good advice, staying away from seed oils. That's a big one, like canola oil and vegetable oil, and sticking with
lard,
olive oil and lard. Yeah. Butter, real butter,
yep.
You know, ghee, that sort of thing. And for me, I'm 41, I'm going to be 42 next month. And, you know, I want to live. So I've tried to take, you know, do as much as I can for my own well-being. So that's, you know, changing my diet and trying to eat, you know, whole foods. And I'm looking on the back of the box for ingredients and annoying my wife when she buys something that might have something that sounds quote unquote scientific, you know, science made. So, you know, hopefully I don't go too overboard where she wants to leave me, but you know, I think health food stuff has definitely made its way over to the States. And, you know, it's one of those things where you also want to make sure that there are at least, you know, third parties out there that you can trust who are, you know, doing the testing and stuff like that. And I know you guys often talk about the nanny state. No, I'm not looking at, you know, government regulators, but with all the crap out there, it's like, you know, who can you trust? And it seems like the way that Chris describes this guy, like maybe this guy isn't the best guy to go and get your your health nutrients from.
But it does amuse me when you've got these people who seem to be experts in everything. In his case, both COVID and diet and
genetics, which is what he's actually qualified in.
Oh, is that actually?
Yeah,
what his academic background is. So we shall return to Tim Spector, no doubt, in what is increasingly becoming the kind of Chris settling scores section of the show. Thoroughly enjoy it each summer. Should we get to some questions from the postbag?
Oh yeah, the postbag.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So got a bunch of questions here. Many of them themed around comedy and offence, as you could probably guess. So let's kick off with one of these questions on comedy and offence. So asking if comedians and stand-ups are feeling gagged, censored by the times in which we live. He says here that he knows friends in work who say that even banter, kind of jovial exchanges between colleagues, are something where HR are getting involved these days. So, Lou, do you think that this kind of sanitisation of comedy is sort of filtering out from just the world of professional stand-ups and just into society in general? Is that something that you've noticed?
Yeah, I've had people, you know, reach out to me over the years saying that they really enjoy my stuff, but they will not like it or share it on the off chance that they can get in trouble with at work. And now that could be, they can get in trouble with work at work. Maybe they're afraid of losing their job, or maybe just something as simple as, you know, they have to go in every day and talk and look at their coworkers. And if they like a joke or something like that, you know, it might, you know, affect their work relationship. I know that for, you know, for some comedians, there are, you know, there are some topics that they don't want to touch because the juice isn't worth the squeeze, where it's sort of like, why am I even going to do this when I can get a, you know, so much backlash? There's that. And then I think there's also just a lot of comedians too, who I think over the years have been pressured to comment on stuff that they have no interest in commenting on. Like there are so many comedians that, you know, their whole routines are, you know, are apolitical, have nothing to do with politics. And now, you know, something happens and that they're being asked, hey, why didn't you change your thumbnail on Instagram or Facebook? But I think, you know, with that being said, I do think that comedians are feeling more empowered to talk about the stuff that they want to talk about or not talk about the stuff that they want to talk about. I think we've reached peak woke in some aspects, maybe not everywhere. You know, maybe there's still farther to go. But I think in comedy, it's definitely come around.
When you were saying that about comedians feeling that they have to hold forth on these issues, I am reminded of that great Chappelle bit from years ago where he talks about watching the TV after 9/11, watching the news, and for some reason they call up Ja Rule, his perspective on events. So definitely reminded me of that. Lou, there's another question here about punching up and punching down, which is something, the allegation of punching down has certainly been thrown Ricky Gervais and Dave Chappelle's way in recent days, as well as over the past couple of years. And the question here is really about what is punching down now? Because according to people who wrote that mad piece in The Guardian, it's making any jokes about gender ideology or transgenderism, what have you. But at the same time, trans activists really set the agenda in a lot of particularly kind of liberal elite spaces. They have a hell of a lot of power. They have managed to get people cancelled, at least through menacing various institutions and so on. So when people talk about punching up and punching down, is it always as straightforward as some people are making out, I guess?
Oh, yeah, definitely not. I mean, I guess what we have to bring in intersectionality and hierarchies and all that stuff. And for me, it's just way too much math to do. You know, the idea that, you know, there are certain people, it's like, okay, I can make fun of you because you're a billionaire, but your legs don't work. Therefore, that might, you know, take away a few of your billions. And now, you know, and I think the whole punching up, punching down thing is very condescending. Just this idea that I can't make fun of you because you're beneath me. Sorry, you know. And if anything, I think you know, comedy is a great equalizer. And what I've noticed, and I have a lot of fun online. So if anybody is on Twitter or any of the other platforms, and you're not having fun, then I think you're just doing it wrong. But it is funny to come across people who think that just saying like, oh, well, you're a white man, shut up. I guess if that's going to work, because when you're like, no, I'm going to continue to speak, I'm going to say whatever the hell I like, they have no power. You know, anybody who's you know, trying to shut you up, especially in a, you know, on a forum like that, it's fun to play with them, I think.
Can I chip in on this? Because I was actually thinking about this very question in relation to the trans jokes and those two specials. Because as part of the outrage about it, the usual clip by James Acaster got put around Twitter. It was a very unfunny bit, which is just quite poor sarcasm, really. In which he basically said, look, this is punching down. And in one sense, obviously it is, because someone who's trans and just trying to get on quietly in their life, you know, living the life they want to live, they, you know, obviously do face a lot of discrimination and challenges, right? I'm not talking about the people pretending to be women to get into women's prisons or the complete, you know, absolute weirdos who just want attention. I just mean not normal trans people. But on the other hand, the people who are kind of enforcing this gender ideology are very powerful people. You know, it's the New York Times and numerous, you know, senior academics and, you know, in Canada, the government, right? So it can be both, I would have thought. It's kind of both. And I think the lesson is that punching down, like Lou says, doesn't really matter so long as it's funny.
And I've had experiences too where, you know, if I make jokes about, you know, at the expense of, you know, trans ideology, we'll put it like that. The amount of times that I have people come back at me and make fun of my receding hairline is hilarious. There are instances where I'm interacting with people with body dysmorphia who hate their bodies and want to change their bodies, and they're making fun of the fact that my hairline is receding. And stuff like that, I just think is priceless. I think it's, and plus I don't really care. Out of all the things you can make fun of me, if there's one thing I really don't give a shit about, it's definitely my locks going back.
So before we wrap up here, and I'll let you guys get back to your evenings, Chris, we've got a question here, which I know the answer to, but I think you should answer it, which is about the postbag jingle. This is from Josh and Stanley asking, just a quick question for the postbag. Are the lyrics of the postbag jingle, A, it's bulging, I hear, B, it's bulging, A, or C, something else? Could you clarify this for the listeners out there?
I'm not quite sure. I'm glad you know the answer, because I'm not quite sure. I mean, it wasn't really an official part of the postbag jingle there, listener. I recorded that jingle with, as you can probably tell, you know, it took me a long time, a lot of multi-tracking. You know, spent several days trying to get it absolutely tip-top, which is why it's so good. And then I said it's bouldering in a slightly different context, and Tom copied it and stuck it on the end of the jingle. I mean, as far as I recall, it just says it's bouldering.
I'm pretty
what
sure.
It's
bouldering, I hear. I should credit Rob Harris, who used to edit this podcast, who put that on there and put the nice. But yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a nice touch. Yeah, okay. Yes, it's bouldering, I hear.
I like the hardcore fan who wants to know these kinds of inside track notes. But anyway. Lou, thanks so much for joining us today. If anyone wants to find you, look at your work, follow you, where can they go?
Yeah, you can go to thelouperez.com and check out my book, That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore, available on Amazon and everywhere else.
Brilliant.
What's it about, Lou? Give us a quick elevator pitch for the book.
It is, it's the way to save comedy, the only way to save comedy.
You've got to buy it to find out. Brilliant. Lou, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.